WMAL News at 7. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. The statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville that helped spark the deadly Unite the Right rally is coming down today. A statue of Stonewall Jackson is also being removed. Talks about removing the Lee statue in 2016 led to the Unite the Right rally in 2017, where white nationalists clashed with counter-protesters, killing a woman. What happens to the statues is up to the city council. For now, they'll go in storage. The council has asked museums, historical societies, and other groups if they want them. The city manager says they've gotten 10 responses. Also coming down today, the last of the fencing around the Capitol. Crews started removing it yesterday. Capitol Hill resident and founder of Don't Fence the Capitol, Allison Cunningham.
We have a group of volunteers who have been working tirelessly, organizing behind the scenes. We have over 34,000 signatures on our petition opposing a permanent fence around the Capitol, and we're just very excited to see that we're moving to this next step.
The group will be celebrating on the East Front this morning at 11. It's expected to take a few days to remove the entire fence. And the new House committee set up to investigate the Capitol riot is expected to meet in the next 2 weeks.
Committee Chairman Benny Thompson says the first session will set the tone. Telling the Associated Press, the panel will hear from first responders who were beaten by a mob that breached the Capitol as Congress certified the Electoral College. Thompson, a Democrat who also chairs the House Homeland Security Committee, says members of the panel had an initial strategy session this week. Just two Republicans voted with Democrats to establish the select committee. One of them, Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney, was named to the panel by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Jared Halpern, Fox News.
An Anne Arundel County police officer is seriously injured and another person hurt after a crash last night. Police say it happened around 8:45 on Annapolis Road and Disney Avenue. The officer's at shock trauma. The other person involved in the crash is at a hospital with minor injuries. Police are trying to figure out what happened. A Louisiana police officer is shot in the head and killed last night while responding to a domestic disturbance call. Sheriff Jason Parker.
We lost a good man. Family lost, good husband, good father, good Webster Parish deputy.
Parker says a suspect barricaded himself in his home but was eventually taken into custody. If you want to get a COVID vaccine at Six Flags in Bowie, it's your last day to do it. Maryland's first mass vaccination site will shut down after today. Chaz EB with the Maryland Emergency Management Agency.
It was up and running for 5 months. Which is great. We were able to reach 340,000 administrations, roughly. At its peak, it was doing about 5,000 per day, which is excellent, especially for a drive-through site.
EB says now the focus will turn to mobile vaccines to try to get jabs in arms of people who are on the fence about the shot. WMAL Sports, the Nats fell to the Giants 5-3. That series continues today at 4:05. Traffic and weather next on WMAL. WMAL traffic, here's LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
Around the Beltway, both in Virginia and in Maryland, on the inner loop and outer loop, you're not tapping the brakes, no construction, and no accidents to tell you about. In D.C., on 395, on the southbound side, traffic is slow between 14th Street and the Pentagon. Now, heads up on 66 westbound in Vienna, you'll find traffic slow between Nutley Street and the Vienna Metro Station. And on Old Georgetown Road in North Bethesda, both lanes, northbound and southbound, are blocked right now because of a utility pole in the roadway at Tilden Lane. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Well, a beautiful Saturday ahead this morning. Very comfortable temperatures climbing out of the 60s and 70s. High temperatures this afternoon in the mid-80s, but what I like about today is the humidity will be nice and low. So take advantage, get outside and enjoy it, because humidity levels starting to rise overnight tonight. Tomorrow, hotter, more humid. We're back to 90 degrees with a slight chance for a pop-up shower or thunderstorm during the afternoon and evening. I'm 7 News meteorologist Eileen Whalen in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
I'm Heather Curtis on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
Now, the Saturday morning update.
It's hour two of the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. John Gizzi is the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com and Newsmax TV, joins us every Saturday morning. John, great to have you with us once again.
Great to be here, especially since I'm not out ducking the rain the way I was yesterday.
Well, you were at the White House yesterday as quite a bit of activity. The president making some remarks, Jen Psaki, of course, doing a press briefing. What were some of the highlights from the White House yesterday?
The big news was what delayed the press briefing by 10 minutes, and that was the president's call to Vladimir Putin. Essentially, there were two subjects that were discussed. No details followed. They were Afghanistan and the withdrawal of U.S. troops. And then, of course, the president's warnings, which he had begun when he met with Mr. Putin in Geneva, not to launch a cyber attack against the U.S. or else. It should be noted that probably in this case, President Putin relied on his usual plausible deniability and said that Russia was not and would not be involved in any cyber attacks. In any way that you look at it, there was very little substance to come out from the official White House line on what the man in Washington said to the man in the Kremlin. However, most people seem to believe it's good when the two of them talk, as has always been the case since the hotline started between Kennedy and Khrushchev more than a half century ago.
What were the president's comments on Afghanistan?
Very simply, he defends the concept of all U.S. troops being withdrawn. He reiterated his point that after 20 years, the United States' continued presence in Afghanistan would only prolong a situation and leave Americans in danger, that their mission is accomplished as he sees fit. What remains is the rescue and the complete evacuation of the interpreters and others who helped the United States when they were a presence in Kabul. Now, one postscript to this, and this is very important. To many, it seems like it's a 2.0 version of Saigon in 1975, that the evacuation of Americans and their allies is being accomplished because the enemy is going to invade very soon. In the case of Afghanistan, it would seem that the Taliban is on the verge of coming back into power and resuming complete control over Afghanistan. If that's the case, it's going to be nothing short of a giant gulag for that region of the world. But the president says the U.S. has to get out, and that's the position he's taken from the beginning.
While we're on international affairs, John, big story this week, of course, the assassination of the Haitian president. How does that impact the U.S. moving forward?
I realize that at first glance, Haiti, a very troubled country for more than two centuries, does not seem to have an impact on the U.S., but it certainly does. For one thing, after having been ravaged by floods and hurricanes, and now political turmoil, it's not going to surprise anyone if a lot of Haitians make a pilgrimage north. And that could mean another border crisis, particularly in Florida. We've seen this before with the Haitian boat people, and we could easily see it again. Now, remember at this time, the death of President Moissy comes when the person who is next in line, the Chief Justice of Haiti, died 6 weeks ago from a COVID-related illness, and the acting Prime Minister, Claude Joseph, someone only on the job for a short time, is the man in charge in Port-au-Prince. Put another way, that means that the government is on very thin ice in Haiti. It could topple relatively easily, and this would just accentuate the flight of refugees to the United States.
And this was not an individual assassin. This was a group effort, right?
This is a group effort. 17 prisoners are now being held by the Haitian security police. Virtually all of them are from Colombia, and there are two American citizens of Haitian descent. Eight are still at large. This leads to speculation that it could be a drug cartel trying to establish a new sphere of business, or it could be hired mercenaries by a force hoping to take over the government and this time outsourcing the revolution.
Well, it's been weeks, and they finally have announced a winner in the Democratic mayoral primary in New York. Tell us about who it is and what pressures he may face from members of his own party.
Simply put, Rick, Eric Adams, Brooklyn Borough President and 20-year New York City police officer, won the all-important Democratic primary for mayor. He is the anti de Blasio. The outgoing mayor, Bill de Blasio, was seen as someone very hostile to police, the embodiment in officialdom of the defund the police movement. Eric Adams defended his former comrades among the Long Blue Line, came out strongly against defunding the police, and even said if he were mayor, he might just carry a gun in the official mayoral mansion, Gracie Mansion. Someone like that, it is interesting to note how he won. He drew 75% of the vote among fellow black New Yorkers, as well as Hispanics and Asians who live in Brooklyn, Bronx, and Queens. In other words, the people who are most vulnerable to crime. The runner-up, Sanitation Commissioner Catherine Garcia, won big in the gentrified areas of the boroughs and in Midtown Manhattan. In other words, where people are relatively safe from crime. All told, this is a campaign that mobilized progressives, but it mobilized more who feared crime and wanted a mayor who would stand by the police. They appear to have gotten it in Eric Adams.
And there was another election announcement made in the New York City area this week, and you chalk up a win for Donald Trump in that one?
I certainly would. Vito Fisella, former congressman, left office in disgrace 13 years ago when it was revealed that he had a second family in Washington, D.C., roared back and narrowly, and I mean by 200 votes out of 18,000 cast, won the Republican nomination for borough president of Staten Island. What helped him in that? A last-minute endorsement from Donald Trump. And remember, scandal notwithstanding, Mr. Fisella got in the race in March, which was very late, when most Republicans had committed to another candidate for running. Clearly, the Donald Trump endorsement, when it comes to Republican primaries, packs a punch. Vito Fisella's amazing comeback against the odds and on short notice is proof positive of that.
We've seen Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, a lot recently in the media, of course, with his stance on the border and his efforts to build his own border wall, since the feds won't do it. He may have some competition from polar opposites when it comes to the next gubernatorial race. What's the latest down there?
Alan West, former congressman from Florida, retired Army lieutenant colonel, and until recently Republican state chairman, is running to the right of Greg Abbott. He doesn't think the governor has done a good job in protecting the borders, even though Governor Abbott just recently announced $250 million to build a border wall across the southern border of the Lone Star State. Alan West promises to be tougher on this issue. And this comes at a time that Governor Abbott, seeking a third term, has the endorsement of Donald Trump and has raised $55 million toward his third term bid. Now, what more Texans are talking about is a poll of all voters showing that in the general election, Governor Abbott beats Matthew McConaughey by 39-38% of the vote. McConaughey, native of Uvalde, Texas, now a resident of Austin, has been eyeing a race for governor. He has not said whether he would run as an independent or as a Democrat, but most Texans I know think he will go Democratic. His views on issues are murky. He calls himself a raging moderate, and he's a gun owner, like 99.9% of Texans are. In Texas, they think gun control means how straight is your aim. I might add that if he makes a run next year, Matthew McConaughey will be 52 years old. Old for someone who's on the screen all the time and 3 years younger than Ronald Reagan was when he was elected governor of California in 1966. One thing I would say, only recently learning about the race, I would say without hesitation that probably my colleagues will stand in line for blocks just to get credentials to cover Matthew McConaughey if he makes the race.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com and Newsmax TV. Follow him on Twitter at John Gizzi. Have a great weekend, John.
Have a terrific weekend, and remember, stay inside. It's hot and it's rainy.
You know, it's sunny one minute and rains the next. Hey, we're going to talk to Jim Trustee next. We're going to get his read on the sentencing of Michael Avenatti. But first, Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
First in Maryland, North Bethesda, Old Georgetown Road. That road is blocked both directions, northbound and southbound at Tilden Lane for a fallen utility pole in the roadway. Now into D.C., on 295 and 695, no delays, but on 395 southbound, you'll find traffic slow between 14th Street Bridge and the Pentagon. And on 66 westbound in Vienna, traffic is slow between Nutley Street exit 62 and the Vienna Metro Station exit 62. And finally, on 95 in Virginia, it's clear sailing between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, northbound and southbound. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Well, a beautiful Saturday ahead this morning. Very comfortable temperatures climbing out of the 60s and 70s. High temperatures this afternoon in the mid-80s. But what I like about today is the humidity will be nice and low. So take advantage, get outside and enjoy it, because humidity levels starting to rise overnight tonight. Tomorrow, hotter, more humid. We're back to 90 degrees with a slight chance for a pop-up shower or thunderstorm during the afternoon and evening. I'm 7 News meteorologist Eileen Whalen in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
68 degrees in the nation's capital, 721 on the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
The Saturday morning update continues, and we were talking with Jim Trustee earlier, and we saved the best for last. We've got a story. Let me read the paragraph, Jim, from the Associated Press. A tearful, repentant Michael Avenatti, the brash lawyer who once represented Stormy Daniels in lawsuits against President Donald Trump, was sentenced Thursday to 2.5 years in prison for trying to extort up to $25 million from Nike by threatening the company with bad publicity. I just cannot get over the accolades that Michael Avenatti was receiving from CNN, MSNBC, CBS. I mean, everybody was in love with this guy because he was the guy that was going to take down Donald Trump. And now, 2.5 years behind bars for him.
Yeah, Rick, you've actually sold it short in terms of the media accolades. I remember specifically, and I saw the clip again recently, of a host referring to the Holy Spirit when Avenatti was in the room spouting off about Stormy and Donald Trump. I mean, the aspirations they pinned on this reptilian lawyer to become president someday is just kind of amazing. And I will say this, as I call him a reptile, this is not schadenfreude. Like, this is not just glee that a human being has been broken down or somehow is being held accountable for his own conduct. This guy was a terrible person in terms of his conduct, day in and day out. He did, again, damage to the profession of lawyers, which it's not like it's the first time, but it doesn't mean I like seeing it when somebody like him really brings down the whole profession. He fills every stereotype you can imagine. So this is not about schadenfreude. This is about justice. But I do think that this first exercise, this first trial, and the sentencing that just concluded late this week had some interesting kind of internal lessons for our listeners.
Well, Jim, I think there are also some lessons for some of the pundits as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, certainly the shame component is probably legitimate. I mean, this is a type A personality guy that thought he was flying very high with all the, you know, accolades he was getting. And I think it's probably sincere when he says that he knows that his life has been, essentially professional life, has been ruined.
Jim, this Nike case was not the first of his troubles or his rather shady behavior. He was in debt for millions of dollars. And how does all this play into the sentencing?
Yeah, so that's the thing that's really, to me, is going to be very fascinating. He has two other cases pending, so we've got a lot to digest over the next year or so. But I think it starts with just understanding a little bit about the federal sentencing process. Every judge, every federal judge, begins their sentencing by determining the sentencing guidelines, this advisory guideline range. It's a function of basically what the conduct was and the history of the person. So in other words, if it's a murder, the guidelines are going to be very high. If it's a trespass, they'll be very low. If a person has a very big criminal record, all of their numbers go up too. And this range is something the judge has to at least give lip service to. It doesn't mean they have to stay in the range, but they have to start with that calculation, which is designed to give uniformity in federal sentencing. In this case, the sentencing guideline range that was determined by the probation office and agreed to by the government was 135 to 168 months. So you're talking 11 to 14 years, roughly. That's the presumptive landing that this guy was supposed to have after going to trial. And I should just add, the federal system puts a real premium on pleading guilty. You know, if you go to trial and you're found guilty, you tend to have a much more difficult outcome from the defense perspective. Now, the defense knew those numbers. They disagreed with them. And they said, Judge, 6 months in home detention will be just fine. That might have been shooting for the stars and settling for the moon. But they turned out to be not that far off. Now, this is the part that I think is kind of intriguing. The government, in their sentencing memo, told the judge that he should receive a very substantial sentence. It's a very vague phrase, Rick. It's a very kind of insubstantial way of putting things, because federal prosecutors ask for a specific sentence or a sentencing range all the time. So that was really a signal to this judge that they're okay going below those sentencing guidelines. It doesn't read that way if you haven't lived it, but if you look at it from the perspective of someone who's been a prosecutor who does defense work, you realize that's an intentional phrasing to kind of signal to the judge that it's okay to go below that 135 to 168, maybe not down to 6 months, but to go below. So I think that was a big part of the sentence here, was that telegraph that came from the government. I think the other things are he had racked up $11 million in debt, so they probably believed him that this was somewhat of a crime of desperation. You also didn't have actual money lost by Nike. You know, they got onto the scheme very quickly, turned it over to law enforcement, and had some very incriminating phone calls that got him convicted. By the way, Nike asked for $1 million in attorney fees. That might have actually backfired a little bit. That's not the most sympathetic moment coming from them. So there's a lot that goes into these sentences that are supposed to be individualized factors, and I think that probably was true here. But keep in mind, two more trials and presumptively consecutive sentences means he's not out of the woods by a long shot.
One more quote from the Associated Press story, Jim. As he left the courthouse in the rain, Avenatti stopped briefly before a set of microphones while his attorney, Danya Perry, told reporters, quote, "A new Michael Avenatti is deeply humbled as a result of this experience." The judge agreed, noting that Avenatti had not shown contrition or accepted responsibility for his crimes until Thursday, when he expressed, quote, "What I believe to be sincere remorse," that the judge believed to be sincere remorse. You buying that, Jim? Or is this just the guy about to get sentenced is like, he's an attorney, he knows now's the only chance he's got?
Yeah, I mean, look, I wasn't in the courtroom, so who knows? But he certainly might have had an onion in his pocket that he started to peel right on cue and get some tears out. So it sounds a little convenient. You know, the real victim, his client, who was basically used for this extortion scheme, he gave a victim impact statement that said, Avenatti's never apologized to me. So, you know, going to trial, not apologizing to the actual victim, but turning on the tears on the day of the sentencing, it rings like a little bit of theater.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. As always, Jim, thank you very much. And you can follow Jim on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
We're at 728 Saturday Morning Update, WMAL. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and KT McFarlander coming up.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington.
America's reopening. Hear it here. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus station. News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. After years of legal battles, the controversial statue in Charlottesville of Confederate General Robert E. Lee will be taken down today, along with a statue of Stonewall Jackson. A plan to remove the statue in 2017 helped lead to the deadly Unite the Right rally in 2018, where white nationalists clashed with counter-protesters. The statues will go into storage for now. The city's considering requests from museums and historical societies who would like them. There'll be a celebration at the Capitol today as the fence installed after the Capitol riot is taken down. Capitol Hill resident and founder of Don't Fence the Capitol, Allison Cunningham's excited.
We want to make sure that it's very clear that the activities that occurred, the insurrection on January 6th, did not permanently alter our access to the Capitol building, our access to democracy or democratic processes.
Her group's hosting a celebration on the East Front this morning at 11. Ditch the masks and get back into the classrooms. That's the CDC's newest guidance on mask wearing in schools.
The CDC says fully vaccinated teachers and students don't need to wear masks when inside school buildings. However, recommends unvaccinated individuals, including children, still wear masks. It also strongly recommends schools open in the fall.
Fox's Kevin Cork. WMAL Sports, the Nats fell to the Giants. Traffic and weather next. WMAL Traffic, here's LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
In D.C. on 295, the Anacostia Freeway northbound traffic is jammed up between Pennsylvania Avenue and East Capitol Street. Now into Prince George's County on the BW Parkway southbound, that's jammed from a Powder Mill Road to NASA Goddard. No delays on the northbound side of the BW Parkway. In D.C. on 395 northbound, you'll find that jammed up between 14th Street Bridge and the Pentagon. And in Vienna on 66 westbound, traffic is slow from Nutley Street to the Vienna Metro Station. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
A beautiful Saturday awaits you, so make plans to get outside today. This morning, temperatures comfortable in the 60s and 70s. We're going to warm into the mid-80s this afternoon, but the humidity will be low. So get out and enjoy it, because change is coming for your Sunday. Hot, humid, our high 90. We could have a pop-up shower or thunderstorm during the afternoon and evening, and then a heat wave next week. Highs in the low to mid-90s each day. I'm 7 News meteorologist Eileen Whalen in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
I'm Heather Curtis on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
It's the Saturday Morning Update, 7:36. I'm Rick Fowler. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer joins us. He is the author of Operation Dark Heart, and he is the president of the London Center for Policy Research. Tony, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Always great to join you.
Always great to have you, Tony. Afghanistan in the headlines, yeah. And a story from the Voice of America. They're saying that many Afghans who had hoped the Taliban would reform their extreme views amid ongoing talks with the Afghan government and the U.S. troop withdrawal have been disappointed by new severe restrictions imposed on local populations. And that goes back to some of the restrictions on women, forcing them into the interpretations of a strict Sharia law, going back to 2001. And you've written an article at spectatorworld.com, the headline on it, Can the U.S. Redeem Itself in Afghanistan? And in reading the article, Tony, I thought it was very interesting. You took us through the steps all the way back to 2001. So walk us through what you really outline in the article, sort of the history here.
Yeah, so I try to put in perspective why it's important to not completely abandon the mission. And what you said, Rick, regarding the perception of the Taliban is a key issue, no doubt. But at the same time, the basic premise is we could have deployed 500,000 troops and kept them there 10 years. And the moment we decide to pull out from our nation-building role, you're going to see it revert to the state it was before. And that's what we're seeing here. We had been effective in our entry into Afghanistan in 2001 by working with the Afghan militia forces. They were the key. That is to say, boy, people don't like this word, but it's the truth, warlords. All these people who traditionally run the different regions They have different ethnic backgrounds, and they're the ones who really are the power in Afghanistan. There's no tradition of a central democracy. And so we wasted nearly 20 years trying to basically push something, promote something on the Afghan people that they just don't want. So instead of spending time investing in partnerships with the warlords, with those who actually run the country, and I argue in the article, the Afghan people aren't ungoverned, they're self-governed. They're very much into small cellular governance. Many of the males, let alone females, many people born in Afghanistan live and die never moving more than 10 miles from the spot on earth they're born. They're not an advanced culture with a lot of traditions of deep democratic principles. So the idea that we were going to change, 10,000 years of momentum of history was insane, as many of us said this. So at this point, we have to figure out a way to salvage both the ideals of why did people go and fight and die or spend time there, and they need to be honored for the service, their service in Afghanistan. And also, what is our role there now? And it's not nation building. We have a responsibility to help work with our regional allies and the people of Afghanistan. We shouldn't abandon them. But at the same time, we have to understand our role there as special operations and intelligence gathering focused on counterterrorism. So that's a very long way of saying, it's sad that we have fought and won an initial victory, chose to go in a direction which jeopardized that victory. And now here we are 20 years later trying to figure out a path forward. And I think that's what I was trying to say. And yes, we're going to have some real issues with what happens when the Taliban comes in, because we didn't spend the time to work with the local tribal leaders to try to create a tapestry of cooperation and invested in the central government, which a lot of folks don't give a lot of time for before it's going to expire under the weight of the Taliban.
So you've spoken to several Afghans. What are their sentiments?
Well, they feel that too much money and too many foreign countries are involved. Everybody's had their hand in the till. Everybody's been trying to influence the Afghan people and make investments in this, that, and the other. And they really do feel sad, the ones I've spoken to, about our departure. They felt, many of them are now naturalized Americans, that they like the idea of a strong America being there. With that said, my counter to that is, it's great that we've been there to help the Afghan people, but the Afghan people have to make a choice to help themselves at a certain time. The biggest country which I see coming in now, and Gordon Chang has reflected this in some of his recent comments, is China. China's invested in two copper mines. They have the Silk Road Initiative, where they want to build trains, railroads, and roads through the region to create essentially the Belt Initiative, which recreates the old Silk Roads. And that's what they want to do. I think the Chinese are going to go in there and they're going to try to increase their influence and perhaps even try to replace us as the central organization that helps promote a central government within Afghanistan.
And as far as the future and what it means for our national security, the Taliban this morning is claiming that they have now taken over 80% of the country. I don't know if that's a legitimate number because it is coming from the Taliban, but assume that they do take a key portion of the country. What does that mean for our national defense moving forward, if anything?
I don't think the Taliban are going to want to recreate the same circumstance of before 2001. Plus, the Saudis, remember during that time, the late 90s, early 2000s, the Saudis were funding a great deal of the terrorism there. Bin Laden and company were being funded heavily by the Saudis. Matter of fact, there was a point in time where an assassination was being contemplated by us regarding Bin Laden, and the only reason it was called off is because the chief of Saudi intelligence was on a falconing expedition with him. So I don't believe there'll be similar circumstance regarding Al-Qaeda or even ISIS. As a matter of fact, I think ISIS is a natural enemy of the Taliban. With that said, I don't see us being friends with them. But I don't see the conditions being present that created the Al-Qaeda using it as a base of operations we did before 2001.
And one note I wanted to get with you on, of course, we've seen the ransomware attacks most recently on 1,500 companies in the past week. You make a point that it's not just the Russians. Who are the other players that could be looking at attacking our internet structure?
Well, anybody who has a computer and half a brain. Let me tell you, Rick, this is going to be a bad time, because the overall perception of our adversaries is that the Biden administration doesn't know what it's doing. It's not reacting vigorously or aggressively. And the more you see successes talked about, the more you're going to see people attempting. And so this is partly, I think, feedback to the success of the ransomware attacks. You're just going to see that more, copycats and others. And plus you have nation states, China, Iran, North Korea, and obviously Russia, who are going to be trying to do everything they can to test out what works and doesn't work. And yeah, you may well see the fingerprints of Russian technology in these attacks. Doesn't mean the Russians are doing it. And one of the comments is, well, is Putin aware of everything? Putin is generally aware of everything that the Russian intelligence service does. I don't think he sits there personally and looks over the shoulder of folks, but yes, he's going to tell them to see what they can do to gain influence and access and disrupt our economic interests. It's just the way it works. And until the Biden administration figures out a way to counter this comprehensively and work with industry to stop, you know, these events, you're going to continue to see an expansion of it. It's just the way things work. At this point, I don't see any messaging or any programs from the Biden administration that actually is going to be successful in countering this.
Well, supposedly Biden brought it up with him in the first meeting, and then had another phone call yesterday, and it's like, you have to stop this now. Don't do this anymore. We need to see some action, at least some slight display of action being taken, not necessarily against the Russian government, but against some hackers somewhere to say, hey, we're doing something.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think there's things we can do both offensively and defensively. Look, defensively, we could put out what we called honeypots. Back in the old days, we would actually be able to kind of put out things that look like a legitimate target and try to get these folks, these hackers, to get into them so we can monitor how they do it, who they are, trace them back, things like that. We had some very sophisticated programs back even in the early days of doing this. I'm just not convinced that Biden and his current DHS and DOD staff are all that willing to do it, because it means being permitting people to be very aggressive in doing things. And I just don't see that coming from the current leadership of the administration.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and he also hosts the Thought to Action podcast. And what's the topic this week?
So China red alert. We're going to be going through and talking about a number of things. David Goldman, one of our senior fellows, has been talking a great deal about the economic issues. And we'll be soon having Gordon Chang on probably part two of that. And Gordon will continue to expand his understanding of where everything's going with China. So thanks for bringing it up.
You bet. And you will find that at londoncenter.org. Tony, thank you very much.
Thank you.
7:46, Saturday Morning Updates, WMAL. KT McFarland next, but first we head to the WMAL Traffic Center, and Al BD is here this morning.
In Virginia, on 66 westbound in Vienna, traffic is slow between Nutley Street and the Vienna Metro Station. Into D.C., first on 295, you're going to find that jammed up northbound between Pennsylvania Avenue and East Capitol Street. On 395, southbound traffic is slow from the 14th Street Bridge to the Pentagon. On 695 in D.C., currently right now, I have no reports of any construction or any accidents eastbound or westbound. And in Silver Spring on University Boulevard westbound, there is a crash reported at Coldsville Road. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Well, a beautiful Saturday ahead this morning. Very comfortable temperatures climbing out of the 60s and 70s. High temperatures this afternoon in the mid-80s, but what I like about today is the humidity will be nice and low. So take advantage, get outside and enjoy it, because humidity levels starting to rise overnight tonight. Tomorrow, hotter, more humid. We're back to 90 degrees with a slight chance for a pop-up shower or thunderstorm during the afternoon and evening. I'm 7 News meteorologist Eileen Whalen in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
68 degrees on the Saturday Morning Update, and it's 7:48. It's 7:50. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. KT McFarland joins us, and she is the former Deputy National Security Advisor in the Trump administration. She is the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. And she has served national security posts in the Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and, of course, Trump administrations. And KT, it's great to have you with us.
Pleasure and an honor.
Afghanistan has been the lead story on the national front and international front this week. And from your perch where you were in these various administrations and obviously in the Trump administration, as you analyze where we've been and where we're going, what stands out to you?
That we're making the same mistakes that we did in Vietnam, but on a more colossal scale. I was in the White House Situation Room in April 1975 when we evacuated from Saigon, and it was just a searing, horrible moment in American foreign policy and diplomacy, because we had, after 50,000 lives were lost, after billions of dollars were spent, after it tore our society apart with anti-war demonstrations, we were then surrounded by the communists, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, and we had to evacuate from the stronghold we had at the American embassy, and we had to evacuate in helicopters. And I remember saying to myself, we should never do this again. We should never be involved in one of these civil wars that we can't win, and continue to try and try and try, and then ultimately leave in failure. And so here we are doing the same thing in Afghanistan. You know, we heard this from the generals and the political leaders, just like we did in Vietnam. Look, just a few more thousand troops, just another year or so, just a few more, in this case, hundreds of billions of dollars, and we're going to get corruption under control, we're going to have democratic elections, and we just don't ever seem to learn our lesson. That's why it's such a tragedy, because of what it does. But the thing that is even, in this case, even more of a tragedy is for 20 years, we've been so focused on the Middle East and Afghanistan and Iraq and wars we couldn't win that we took our eye off the ball on China, and now, instead of spending trillions fixing our own infrastructure, we built up Afghanistan. Instead of fixing our own education system, we set up schools in Afghanistan that their children wouldn't even go to. And so here we are with a China which is inevitable. They feel that they are now to the tipping point where world domination by the Chinese is inevitable and American decline irreversible. Those aren't exactly true, but who knows what happens next.
Well, I want to ask you about China, because I follow your Twitter feed, and you are mentioning the harvesting of DNA information by the Chinese, and obviously shocking and troubling to Americans. Tell us a little more about the threat there.
Well, I'm worried that, you know, the pieces of the puzzle are now starting to come together, and here's what the pieces are saying. You know, about a couple of years ago, we couldn't figure out why were the Chinese hacking into American healthcare systems and American medical databases. And now we see, you know, the Wuhan lab, what were they doing there? They're doing gain-of-function research, whether we were complicit in it or we were funding it or not. The Chinese military is taking normal, fairly harmless viruses and genetically engineering them to be more lethal and more contagious. And I don't think the Chinese virus, COVID, came intentionally out of that lab. I think it was a lab leak, but they were doing the research nonetheless, a sort of Frankenstein mad scientist research. And once the Chinese understood the lethality of it and the contagious ability of it, they shut down China, but they sent it all around the world. So I think we just got to ask some really serious questions. First of all, about, is our data secure? And secondly, what are the Chinese doing with their military experiments? You know, the Chinese, and you've seen it lately in the last, say, decade or so, where the Chinese constantly talk about the superiority of the Han Chinese ethnic group. China's like 95% of one ethnic group, the Han Chinese. And they're constantly talking, not unlike Nazi Germany, of the superiority of their race. So there's a lot of stuff, a lot of sort of breadcrumbs or puzzle pieces that I think have been yet to put together. Now, maybe what they're doing is just, they just want to dominate the biomedical field and pharmaceuticals in the future. Okay, I get that. But is there something more sinister going on? And that's the big question.
And what can we do about that? I mean, if they're developing bioweaponry, what can we and what can the world do about it?
Well, first of all, we could stop funding research in Chinese labs, for starters. And the second thing we can do is protect our own data. I mean, data privacy legislation is every time it's sort of introduced in Washington, people roll their eyes, and big tech comes and says, look, we don't want to have any infringement on our ability to collect whatever information we want about the American people, whether it's, you know, your pizza preferences or your DNA. But we need to protect that from not only from people who are going to exploit it financially, but people who might medically exploit it. And the whole world needs to wake up to the fact that data is king now. Data is the new weapon. And we, the United States, are particularly far behind the ability to have privacy. The Europeans, in the world today, data, who owns your data? In China and Russia, the government owns your data. In America, private industry owns your data. You know, big tech owns your data. In Europe, well, the people own their data, so they have to give permission for their data to be used. But I think the United States needs a very serious look. And it's just yet another one of the abuses that big tech, because it's so rich, it's so powerful, it buys and sells congressmen readily. But I think we need to really focus on reining these guys in.
We've got about 2 minutes left, and I want to ask you about the ransomware attacks and President Biden's handling of Vladimir Putin. He seemed to be thrilled yesterday that he was able to be communicating with him. But what about a strategy to actually take some action? What have you seen in the Biden administration, and what would you recommend maybe they think about doing?
Well, I think it's a fundamental principle of foreign policy or life. You don't set down red lines. You don't make threats unless you're prepared to carry them out. Whether it's President Obama saying, here's my red line in Syria, or whether it's President Biden saying, here's my red line, don't you dare hack these industries number 1 through 16. By the way, number 17 on up, well, we're not going to punish you for those, but we're going to really focus on number 1 through 16. It's almost like he's asking for Vladimir Putin to test him on it. I mean, look, if you look at all the moves Putin's making around the world, he's constantly pushing up against what he can get away with. And so when President Biden said, here's my list of things you can't dare have Russians hack into, well, it was an open invitation to Putin. And, of course, what is Putin's people are doing? They're hacking into those vital industries.
Yeah, the next 1,500.
The next 15. Right, exactly. And what's the penalty? I mean, it's almost like, I hope this isn't the case, but I wonder, did the Biden administration have any sense of, okay, if A, then B, or you guys do this, and here's what we're going to do the minute you challenge us? I don't know that they did. I think they just figure it's like the good old days when America is so rich and so powerful, we can threaten somebody, and our adversaries sort of cower in the corner and do what we say. Those days are over, and the sooner our leadership understands that and takes efforts to protect the American people from the 21st century threats as opposed to the 20th century threats, the better off we'll be.
K.T. McFarland, the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. Always an honor to have you with us, K.T. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for the Saturday morning update. Garden Sense follows the 8 o'clock news on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. America's reopening. Hear it here. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus station. News now.